Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For Thursday, December 1st, 2016, I'm Ian Hurley. First, a news update with Miranda Myers.
Today's the 25th annual World AIDS Day. As Jacqueline Balt reports, the focus this year is on education and testing.
Today at USC's Keck Medical Center, health professionals were giving out free HIV tests.
It's that simple. It's a finger prick with a little bit of blood from your finger, and we have the results in 1 minute.
The Rand Schrader STD Clinic expected to test more than 50 people throughout the day. Medical Director Joseph Cadden says despite tremendous medical advances, there are still challenges.
Science has done wonders, but society has still kept us behind because it was from very early on stigmatized as you were dirty or bad or you deserved having this disease. So to work against that has been very, very difficult.
Cadden isn't sure if that stigma will ever go away. Community organizer and health promoter Leslie Frias says awareness is key.
I think it's really important education and people has to know about it, you know? And the more important thing is that the risk is for everyone, not for a specific group of people.
USC's Medical Center offers free HIV tests daily. For Annenberg Media, I'm Jacqueline Baltz.
Governor Jerry Brown today named Congressman Xavier Becerra as California's next Attorney General. Becerra will replace Kamala Harris, who was elected to the U.S. Senate. If he is confirmed by the state legislature, Becerra will be California's first Hispanic Attorney General. He will serve the final 2 years of Harris's term, and his congressional seat will be filled through a special election. Becerra has represented L.A. in the House of Representatives since 1992. There's a new website getting attention that lists college professors who are considered to be advancing what it calls leftist propaganda. As Iris Lee reports, ProfessorWatchlist.org has more than 100 names on its list, including one from USC.
2 years ago, USC professor Darry Sragow became the topic of national news when video of one of his lectures went viral.
The Republican Party of California, as I say all the time, on the record, in print, and on radio, and on TV, is the last vestige of any real white people.
Now Sragow is listed on ProfessorWatchlist.org. He is the only professor listed from USC. He was not available to comment today. The website was launched last week by a group called Turning Point USA. It's a nonprofit organization that promotes conservative values among students. The organization was founded by 21-year-old Charlie Kirk, who is considered a rising star in the conservative circles. Lisa Wade was also included in the list. She teaches sociology at Occidental College in Los Angeles.
I'm not surprised that I'm on the list because I research and talk about race, gender, and sexuality. On any list that has the partisan leanings that Turning Point does, I would expect to be on that list.
The website asks students to submit incidents that show extreme liberal bias. It says they'll only publish profiles on professors that have been reported by credible sources. While some professors see the list as a threat to academic freedom, others, like Lisa Wade, thinks it's just a matter of free speech.
I think that it is a very uncertain time right now, and I can understand why people are concerned, but I certainly wouldn't ever suggest that people can't say whatever they would like to say about me.
The website is expected to add more professors. There are currently professors from 8 schools around the Los Angeles area. For Annenberg Media, I'm Iris Lee.
The federal government has put a nationwide ban on smoking in public housing. The rule will take effect early next year, which is when the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles had already planned to implement their own ban. Peggy Toy is the director of UCLA's Smoke-Free Air for Everyone project, and she says smoking is more prevalent in low-income communities.
It has drawn attention to the need for housing to be smoke-free, particularly multi-unit housing. When you're living in an apartment and your neighbor smokes, or even the neighbor a couple of apartments down smokes, you can be affected.
Toy says the next step is making all housing smoke-free in Los Angeles, similar to bans in Pasadena and Santa Monica. USC cornerback Adoree Jackson is one of 4 finalists for the Lott Impact Trophy. The award is given to the College Football Player of the Year who best exemplifies all the qualities of the IMPACT acronym: integrity, maturity, performance, academics, community, and tenacity. The other finalists are Alabama defensive lineman Jonathan Allen, Michigan linebacker Jabril Peppers, and Air Force defensive back Weston Steelhammer. The ceremony is on December 11th in Newport Beach. Better go get your Christmas tree now or you might miss out. Jack Ingracia tells us why.
In the busy center of Hollywood, an old-fashioned holiday season business, Mr. Jingle's Christmas Trees.
You just come in, you find your tree, and it's already cut, ready to go. We just put the stand on it, you take it home.
It's a family business run by Mr. Jingles himself, also known as Scott Sanchez, who owns 8 Christmas tree lots across the country. Employees at Mr. Jingles say business is picking up.
We've been really busy since Thanksgiving Day. This is our supposed to be one of our busiest weekends coming up.
The shop is selling more than 1,000 trees per week, despite the fact that Christmas trees nationally are in short supply, down 26% since 2010, and that's driving prices up.
A 7 foot last year was $91. We're doing $100 this year. The year before it was $75.
Sanchez says the shortage is partly a response to farmers planting fewer seeds in 2008 following the recession, and those trees are ready to be cut this year.
It takes 8 years for a lot of the 7 foot Christmas tree to grow, so this is basically the year 7 where a lot of those come down.
Big box stores like Lowe's and Home Depot are dominating the supply as well. But Sanchez says higher prices haven't slowed business because people still want the traditional holiday experience of picking out and decorating a real live tree. For Annenberg Media, I'm Jake Ingracia.
I'm Miranda Myers, and it's 6 minutes after the hour.
Stay tuned for From Where We Are. Later, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Wesley Lowery. If you've stayed in a hospital recently, the staff probably ask you for your name several times a day. But that's not because they forgot who you are. As Jenny Lauer reports, hospitals are trying to prevent patient mix-ups.
As an actress in Los Angeles, Lola Kelly is used to playing other people. But she doesn't expect to get mistaken for someone else at her doctor's office. Still, it's happened. Twice. The first time, she was 17. Kelly was sexually active and went in for a routine checkup that included tests for STDs and pregnancy. As she was finishing up, a doctor approached, looking somber.
I will never forget her face.
The woman took Kelly into another office.
It was like a sit-down, let's have a conversation room, and I got freaked out. I was sure that I had some horrible disease.
The doctor told Kelly she was pregnant.
She was about to hand me a set of pamphlets, and she said, like, let's talk about your options. And right then, this nurse busted through the door.
The nurse had more news. Kelly's test results had been confused with another patient's. The doctor was mortified.
Said that, like, I'm very, very sorry. I have just checked and triple checked and you are not pregnant.
The second mix-up came about 4 years later. Kelly was a junior in college. She made an appointment at the Student Health Center to get an antibiotic for a sinus infection.
I'm allergic to penicillin, like, very, very much so.
She reminded the doctor about her allergy.
He's like, yeah, yeah, it's on file.
So he wrote a prescription, and Kelly took it to the pharmacy.
They gave me the prescription, and I even got, like, home with it before I opened it and read more carefully the label, and it was penicillin.
When she called to complain,
he said, oh, sorry, I mixed you up with someone else. It was no big deal.
Thousands of patients experience similar incidents in U.S. hospitals every year, sometimes with fatal consequences. That's according to a new report released by ECRI Institute. It's a nonprofit healthcare research organization. Researchers there studied more than 7,600 reports of patient mix-ups voluntarily submitted by hospitals over almost a 3-year period. They found that hospitals routinely mixed up patients during nearly every phase of care, including registration, blood transfusions, surgery, and emergency care. While most of those mistakes didn't actually end up harming patients, about 9% did. Stephanie Eusis is an analyst who worked on the report. In one case, she says,
there was a patient who was in cardiac arrest, and they retrieved the wrong chart. The chart that they retrieved, it was the patient was a do not resuscitate patient. The patient who was in arrest, they did not resuscitate. The patient did pass away.
Hospitals are supposed to ask for 2 forms of identification anytime they interact with patients.
You know, what is your name? And, you know, what is your date of birth?
When things go wrong, it's often because staff forget this step. In many of the reports, USA says,
they specifically stated, I was busy. I didn't have a chance to ask. Or, you know, I got distracted.
Other times, hospitals confuse patients with similar names, such as Mary Smith and Marie Smith, or a father and son with the same first and last name. ECRI Institute says to prevent problems, hospitals should avoid using information such as room numbers to identify patients. They should also make sure patients with similar names aren't placed in the same room. And ECRI wants to educate patients about the importance of the two identifier system.
And a lot of times patients were, well, I just told you that. Why don't you know who I am?
Steps like these will help avoid near-miss situations like Kelly's run-in with penicillin. For Annenberg Media, I'm Jenny Lauer.
If you play video games, you probably know they've changed since the day of Super Mario Brothers. New games feature voice actors creating fleshed-out characters, but voice actors are striking against what they say are unfair working conditions. Brian Marks explains what's at issue in the labor dispute.
For animation aficionados, Phil LaMarr is practically a household name and one of the most recognizable talents in animation voice work.
You can never defeat another if you know not how to defeat yourself.
He's played main characters on Futurama, Samurai Jack, and he voices the Green Lantern. But LaMarr is also a prolific voiceover actor in video games, and since October, he and other members of the Actors Union SAG-AFTRA have been on strike against video game companies. One of the union's biggest goals is to get secondary compensation, or residuals. All actors get a payment up front for acting in movies or TV shows, but if the movie or TV show makes a lot of money, those actors can also get periodic bonuses for being in it. For example, an actor might get a bonus payment every time the movie he was in earns an additional $10 million. If you were in a massive blockbuster, then you can make a lot of additional money over time.
If you're working on a sitcom, you may guest star on it for 1 week, whereas all of the crew are working on it on every episode for, 26 weeks. But the idea that you get paid whenever that episode generates income for the company is part of how you're able to be there and available to do the part.
But video games only pay actors up front. There's no additional payment or bonuses if the game's a hit.
As a video game performer, they generally work a couple times a week if they're doing really, really well. My name is Keith Farley. I'm the chair of the Interactive Negotiating Committee for SAG-AFTRA. So this is about a middle class performers. These are not celebs. These are not people who are living in houses up on the hills. These are people who are living in apartments in Van Nuys, just like a lot of the people who play the games that they helped to create.
Sam Singer represents the video game industry. He says voice actors shouldn't get residuals because it's a technology industry, not entertainment.
Video games are created by coders and people who have long thought out storylines that will help get people engaged and enjoy these games. The industry uses union performers to act and do some of the voices. They play a small but important role in the video game creation, but the real magic happens with technology.
The SAG-AFTRA members are also looking for solutions that address the threat of vocal stress. They want performers to work fewer hours at a time, and they also want the ability to stop a recording session whenever they feel vocally stressed. Phil LaMarr likens it to spending a night at a noisy bar with loud music.
You're talking at, even if you don't realize it, a relatively high level of volume for a significant amount of time. And what's your throat like at the end of an evening at a party or something like that? And that's without doing sounds of being electrocuted, cut in half with a chainsaw, shot in the leg,
The video game industry says it addressed vocal stress in a version of the contract that was ultimately rejected by the union. Regardless of their competing positions, there's no end in sight for this strike, and negotiations are currently on hold. For Annenberg Media, I'm Brian Marks.
When you think about farming in California, you probably don't think of Los Angeles. In this sound portrait, we hear from Elliot Kuhn, who left his job as a teacher to start an urban farm in Panorama City.
In 2010, I was wrapping up my young career as a high school literature teacher, and I was living in Mexico City working at an American school there, and just feeling like I didn't want to just be a classroom teacher. I was finding my heart wasn't quite into it. You asked me 10 years ago, are you going to be a farmer? I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It it seems to encompass everything I really like. I like community, I like education, I enjoy physical work, I enjoy kind of like the creation of life that goes on in farming and stuff like that. So what we sort of honed in on for this season is because we have a pretty large space to grow in ground, I think what we can bring to the market is root crops. And by root crops, I mean things like carrots, radish, beet, onions, things that grow below ground and or right at the surface.
Yeah, no, this is all passion fruit that we just planted this season. So it has a really intricate and amazing flower. And then it has to be pollinated, right, by the bees or another insect. And then it'll have like this little green fruit, but it turns into like a big dark purple. Yeah, I don't see any on there right now. It's kind of past the season for it.
The cool thing about it is connecting with people. It doesn't really matter what race you are, what socioeconomic background you have, what education level. I mean, I think there's just something simple about gardening that's very primal and old, and I think there's something about getting back to it. My name is Elliot Kuhn. I live in Panorama City in Northeast Los Angeles, and I run Cottonwood Urban Farm.
Stephanie De Leon Sick produced that sound portrait. Von Kleinsmid is the namesake of one of the most iconic buildings on campus, but the USC president has a mixed history. Here's Magli Gutier with today's Trojan Tales.
On any given weekday, hundreds of USC students pass through the Von Kleinsmid Center for International and Public Affairs. It was named after USC's fifth president, Rufus Von Kleinsmid.
All I knew about him was that he decided that his building needed to be the tallest, so we built this lovely thing.
Student Maddie Vogel is pointing to a narrow tower shooting out of the center. People might also recognize the building because of its rows of arches and the many flags that hang off of it. Rufus von Kleinsmid headed USC from 1921 to 1942. He established the School of Cinematic Arts and the International Relations Center. So what does it take to have this kind of building named after you?
I mean, I would hope you did something with international relations. I think its message is about being a global citizen and like understanding part of the world, and then obviously being an important like member of the USC community.
Von Kleinsmid was pretty well known worldwide, and he was commended for his leadership on campus during World War II. He shifted curriculum to focus on geography, history, and international relations, all subjects relevant to the wartime era. He also paved the path for USC to become a wartime research institution. He was also an ardent supporter of the eugenics movement. Professor Stern of the University of Michigan is a published author on the subject. She says that Kleinsmid's beliefs were widespread at the time.
You know, this was an era in which Southern California in particular was highly racially segregated.
Von Kleinsmid also co-founded a eugenics research organization called the Human Betterment Foundation. He then sent his research to Adolf Hitler. Not surprisingly, USC does not mention his support of eugenics in its biographies. Student Danya Rafiki is bothered by his ties to the movement.
I think international relations and political science is huge about ethics and morality and things like that. So, I mean, it's annoying that, like, the guy who made sure every brick was perfect and then I get a great education, you know, doesn't stand for, and not even doesn't stand for, but, like, work towards things that I just completely disagree with.
There have been calls to rename the building, but nothing has come of them yet. With Annenberg Media, I'm Magali Gauthier.
Juliette Muir, Katsi Steffen, and Betsy Carter also contributed to this story. As the 2016 football season comes to an end, so does the reign of USC mascot Traveler the Seventh. The noble Wright horse will retire to his home in Burbank after the last game. Amber Bragdon has the story.
The official mascot of USC was named after the horse Robert E. Lee rode during the Civil War. Since 1961, one of the most famed Trojan traditions has been riding Traveler around the field of the Coliseum after every USC touchdown. The current horse is a 25-year-old named Traveler the Seventh. He served as the mascot for 14 years, but he'll soon be retiring to his home in Burbank. His replacement is another pure white steed named Traveler the Eighth. He's been in training for the past year and a half and will officially take over the role next football season. Traveler's rider Hector Aguilar plans to continue his role on Traveler the Eighth. For Annenberg Media, I'm Amber Bragdon.
Wesley Lowery is a national correspondent for The Washington Post who covers race and politics. He won a Pulitzer Prize for the Fatal Force Project, which creates a record of every police-related killing in the United States. He gained national notoriety when he was arrested while covering the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting of Michael Brown. I sat down with him in the studio today to talk about the challenges of covering the protests against police and the repercussions of the election of Donald Trump. That must be such a challenge. Like, you're coming into this community like Ferguson, and, you know, obviously there's other Baltimore, Chicago, New York City. These are vastly different places. So as a reporter, how do you find those angles and understand why this particular community decided to protest at this particular time?
You know, that was what was interesting, was because we often think about, you know, we think historically, we think about issues of like police brutality or police killings as like this problem of these bad big city departments. Like the LAPD might kill somebody, or the NYPD might kill someone, Chicago might kill somebody, Detroit might kill somebody. You know, these aren't Miami. These aren't things that happen where I live. And I think that's one of the reasons that it drove such interest initially in Ferguson. So it's like, what's this place? What's this suburb? What's this? And I think in some ways, there was this assumption, not just by the media, but by a lot of people who were watching the story and thinking of the story. There was this assumption that this place must be different somehow, right? Because this wouldn't happen where I live, and I live in a suburb, but this isn't like New York. So is this just a town full of crazy racists? Is this just this could not happen where I live? And what was beautiful, tragically beautiful over the next few years, was the deterioration and the unwinding of that argument. Where, well, I mean, I don't live in Ferguson. Nothing like this would ever happen where I live, said the person in Charleston, said the person in Cleveland, said the person in Milwaukee, said the person in Charlotte. Where we see, said the person in Tulsa. Where what became so clear is that the story of Ferguson is a story of America, that these issues, that these problems, that these histories exist in all of our major cities and in all of our own backyards, right? This is not a story of that crazy thing that happened over there, but rather it's something that happened over there and may next happen where I'm standing now.
When Ferguson happened, so many people said, this couldn't happen in my town. Mm-hmm. I was telling you earlier, I'm from a small town outside of Philadelphia, and I would argue that was absolutely true then, and I'm not sure how much it's changed now. How do we break that gap so that these people aren't living in a bubble where there isn't racial problems in their town?
Well, and I think that's what's so difficult, is that we as humans have such an inability to routinely interrogate our own biases and to routinely force ourselves to see other people's lived experiences and their humanities, right? We are so incapable sometimes of thinking about how perhaps this is different. And the other thing is, we also believe that everything, the way that our world functions, the way my town functions, the way my city functions, every other town and city must also function this way, right? And so, and we superimpose that bias on how we consume media. So in each of these cities, there have been unique policing policies that have led to deterioration of trust. In New York City, where they are Gardner, you have things like the broken windows policies, mm-hmm. right? Why are multiple police officers harassing a guy selling loose cigarettes on the street, right? Why is that a policing priority? Now, in your city, that might not be the case, right? In the place where you live, if the police are confronting someone, you may feel like it's not going to be about some, they must know something else about this person. Why else would they have done this? No, in New York, actually, they would just confront him for doing something small. In Ferguson, Missouri, at the time Michael Brown was killed, there are more outstanding arrest warrants than there were residents. Why? Because of the way that the police were using speeding tickets and stacking fines and fees and regulations. And what it meant was that for most people living in Ferguson, for most black people living in Ferguson, getting pulled over could mean you were going to jail that night. Now, that creates a different set of incentives and responses than might otherwise, right? And so that might not be how it works in my neighborhood in D.C. And so, again, we look at these, we rip these stories out of the headlines, and we assume that, well, but if this was me or if this is where I live, all of these givens would be true. In reality, we live in a world of little nation states, right, where every state kind of has its own rules, its own unique history. Every town has its own rules and unique histories, and that all factors into any of these given stories.
Finally, nationally, the big news, obviously, recently is the election of Donald Trump.
Of course.
And you've worked with a lot of these groups like Black Lives Matter. You've reported on them and talked with them. And I think that they've moved this conversation forward, and I think in our bubble here in Southern California, we felt like this progressive conversation, this progressive ideas mm-hmm. are just going to keep moving forward. And then the election was a very jarring moment for a lot of people. So what is the reaction that you've seen from the people that you're talking to the election of Donald Trump? And what would you say to young people in terms of how they should react to this kind of news?
You know, I think that sometimes we forget the cyclical nature of history and how the world in which we live in operates. And we assume that because something has always been the way it is right now, it will always be that way, right? So because Obama wins Ohio handily, he has to win Ohio the next time, or Hillary Clinton has to win Ohio, right? Has to win Florida. That because the demographics had trended in this direction, that this must always be the case, and it will always continue to be that way. Because we're having this conversation right now about policing, it will always continue. It will just continue to progress. What we know kind of historically is that that's just not how things work. There's always an action and a reaction, that as a social movement or a racial movement rises, it has its decade, it has its years, and then there's a counteraction to that, right? And that we live on a pendulum that's swinging back and forth. And I think that we make a mistake sometimes, and I think people of all political persuasions do this, that when you're winning or when you seem to be making progress, you assume that progress and that victory is foregone, as opposed to something that is brief and fleeting.
Wesley Lowery, thank you.
Of course, thanks
for joining
me.
Us. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
And yeah, thanks for talking with me.
Of course, anytime.
Lowery's new book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement, is out in bookstores now. If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Megan Coyle with today's Root Source.
Have you ever wondered why we wish people a Merry Christmas instead of a Happy Christmas?
We wish you a Merry Christmas.
The phrase Merry Christmas was actually the older of the two. Merry comes from an old English word, myrie, spelled M-Y-R-G-E, meaning pleasing or delightful. It was made popular in the 16th century by the Christmas carol, We Wish You a Merry Christmas. Happy Christmas didn't arrive on the nativity scene until the 17th century. The word merry is slang for tipsy, so the rise of the temperance movement helped Happy Christmas gain ground. The most famous usage of it is in Clement Clark Moore's poem, A Visit from St. Nick, which ends with Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night. Happy Christmas is still popular in Great Britain to this day, but in the U.S., Merry Christmas made a comeback in the 1900s. Americans heard Merry Christmas in popular songs and movies, and the phrase stuck, kind of like Christmas snow.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
It's the last week of classes, and students are gearing up for the end of the year. From the presidential race to USC beating both football rivals, 2016 has been an eventful year on campus. Sophia Bosk went out today to talk to USC students about the highlights of 2016 and their hopes for 2017.
My biggest highlight is coming to USC and kind of like finding myself here, like making a bunch of new friends, and then also just like trying out different classes and different extracurriculars and just kind of like seeing what college is like.
Definitely one of my highlights was getting my acceptance letter to USC and then coming here from the East Coast. It was a big change, but it was definitely a great decision, and I'm loving all the friends I'm making here and everything.
My resolutions would be to make more time to have fun, because I've been really busy with school, and to make some new friends. Not that my friends aren't good, but just I would like to make some more friends.
I'd say next year is go to grad school or start applying to grad school, as probably studying abroad I feel like is probably the biggest like bucket list thing for me to do.
See you all next year, everyone. That's it for From Where We Are for the semester. Our board operator and executive producer is Rania Niftos. Megan Coyle and Alana Bracken are our producers. Our theme music was composed by Derek Renfro, and the theme music for Trojan Tales was produced by Ryan Montag. Thanks to tech guru Sebastian Grubaugh and George Lavender for their help each week. Join us again next semester, and keep following us on Twitter and Facebook at Annenberg Media. For all of us at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Ian Hurley. Have a great winter break.